Good day, and welcome to today's program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, there will be an opportunity to ask questions during our question-and-answer session. To enter the question queue at any time, you may hit star 6. To remove yourself from queue, you may hit pound at any time. And now I'd like to turn the program over to Ms. Elizabeth Keller. Please go ahead.
Hello, I'm Elizabeth Keller, the Deputy Executive Director for ICMA, the International City-County Management Association, and the moderator for today's conversation. We're the professional association for over 9,000 city and county managers, and we're here today to talk about immigration reform, largely because our members have become increasingly concerned that in the absence of a comprehensive approach to immigration policy, we face greater public health and safety issues. Local government managers see the consequences of this patchwork approach to immigration in their communities every day. Some of the tensions exist because of the conflicting goals of local law enforcement and those of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Community-oriented policing, for example, is a well-regarded law enforcement strategy. For it to succeed, police need to build trust and good communication with all residents in their community. You may recall the October 2002 sniper attacks in the Washington, D.C. area. What you may not remember is that Montgomery County Police Chief Charles Moose issued an appeal to immigrants to come forward if they had witnessed any of the shootings. He felt compelled to make that appeal because of an unrelated but widely reported incident. Authorities in Virginia had stopped a white van near an area where the sniper had made a telephone call and found two undocumented immigrants. They were turned over to the INS, causing fear in immigrant communities. Of course, the circumstances facing our communities vary across the country. City and county managers want to work with their elected officials and residents to build stronger communities. With fewer limited financial resources, local governments focus more on economic development and quality of life issues, which requires integration of immigrants into the community. Crime prevention and protection are priorities for local governments rather than enforcement of civil immigration laws. To examine these issues and develop recommendations for change, ICMA's Governmental Affairs and Policy Committee has released a white paper, Immigration Reform, an Intergovernmental Perspective. I'd like to introduce our speakers now, starting with the author of the paper. Dr. Nadia Rubai Barrett, PhD, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Public Administration at Binghamton University, has worked with local government officials and professional associations for over two decades to address issues of service delivery effectiveness, intergovernmental relations, and the challenges of increasing diversity. Ron Carley, County Manager, Arlington, Virginia, has over 30 years of experience in local government, most of it in Arlington County. Ron is an ICMA credentialed manager and represents ICMA on the National Homeland Security Consortium. He served for 4 years on our Governmental Affairs and Policy Committee. And finally, Michael Dave O'Leary, City Administrator of Shelton, Washington, has joined the local government management profession in 1999, previously serving as County Commissioner for Ada County, Idaho. If I could now turn it over to you, Nadia.
Thank you, Beth. And thank you to those who are participating and listening in on this press conference. What I would like to provide is in a little more detail is some of the challenges facing local governments that are documented in the report that Beth referenced. There are several conditions contributing to what might be called a perfect storm as it relates to immigration and local governments. First, for many years, the sheer numbers of immigrants, both legal and undocumented, entering the United States has been increasing. Second, the diversity of recent immigrant populations in terms of the countries from which they come, the languages they speak, and their cultural values differs more noticeably from the U.S. population than earlier waves of immigrants. Third, immigrants are choosing to settle in places that are well outside traditional gateway cities and states. As such, cities, counties, towns, and villages in urban, suburban, and rural areas in every state across the nation are experiencing immigration in ways that they're largely unprepared for. These conditions have been compounded by the lack of a coherent and comprehensive federal policy on immigration. We have outdated admissions criteria and severe backlogs in the processing of applications and background checks. The immigration and naturalization component of the federal bureaucracy has not received nearly the attention and resources as has the enforcement component in a post-9/11 environment. And the enforcement component of federal policy alternates between being practically non-existent and then alternatively rather heavy-handed. The final straw from a local government perspective is the disproportionate distribution of resources. Several well-respected studies have documented that immigrants, again, both legal and undocumented, are net contributors to the U.S. economy. But two-thirds of the taxes they generate go to the federal government, while two-thirds of the costs are borne at the local and state levels. The revenues collected by the federal government are not being redistributed down to the local level to compensate them for the costs they incur. So what does this mean for local governments? In a nutshell, the ability of local governments to meet their local priorities, namely ensuring public health and public safety, promoting economic development and fiscal responsibility, and fostering a sense of community, is being repeatedly challenged and compromised by the burdens they face due to the federal government's failure to fulfill its responsibilities with respect to immigration. Let me just give you a couple of general examples. When immigrants, even those who are in the U.S. legally, are afraid to report crimes or cooperate with police because of fear of detention or deportation, the ability of local governments to promote public safety is compromised. If immigrants are afraid to seek medical attention for fear of having their immigration status checked, they may end up spreading contagious disease and compromising public health, not just for other immigrants, but also for the native-born population. If immigrants avoid preventative health care and rely on emergency medical services, communities bear unnecessary costs. If local governments opt to cooperate with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, through so-called 287G agreements, the time that local officials spend enforcing federal immigration laws reflects time and resources a local government does not have available to invest in local priorities. And a report just issued in January 2009 by the General Accounting Office documented that there are serious inconsistencies in the way those 287G agreements are implemented and enforced at the local level, creating serious liabilities for local governments. Pent-up frustrations with the lack of federal action have made the issue of immigration a highly contentious and divisive issue in some communities. Community cohesion, thus, is jeopardized if a local government finds itself having to pit the native-born population against the newcomers. The report that Beth mentioned explains the vast array of ways in which local governments are responding to these challenges. Some are declaring sanctuary for illegal immigrants, while others are passing harsh anti-immigrant ordinances that include penalties for anyone employing or even housing an illegal immigrant. Some are signing those 287G agreements with ICE. Some have passed English-only laws, and others are encouraging bilingualism and multilingualism and cultural competence among their employees. Some have opened day laborer centers or hiring halls to facilitate immigrants finding employment, and others have prohibited the creation of those types of facilities. This patchwork of local policies jeopardizes the safety and security of citizens and immigrants alike. It strains small and large businesses relying on immigrant labor, imposes significant burdens on the economic and social fabric of localities, and creates intergovernmental tensions that may impede effective working relations between the national and local governments on other issues. The next two speakers will share stories of how their particular communities have experienced the immigration challenge created by the conditions I described above. Ron, I believe you're speaking next.
Thank you, Nadia, and welcome to everybody to the call. Arlington, Virginia is one of those communities that has experienced a significant increase in immigration and its diversity over the past generation, beginning in the 1970s with a significant influx of people from throughout Southeast Asia, and then into the 80s and 90s with a significant influx of people from Central and South America. We're a community that has approached the immigration issue as a matter of embracing it, not just accepting it passively, but actively embracing it and making a conscious decision as part of our driving vision for our community that we will actually be a diverse and inclusive community. We've concluded that cultural diversity will actually be a competitive edge for us in a global economy. The lack of a national policy, however, and a consistent policy significantly undermines our efforts, and I think the efforts of city and county managers across the country, in that our responsibility ultimately is to create a harmonious, safe, and healthy community. Our job is really to bring communities together with a sense of unity. And what is happening with the lack of a really coherent and consistent national policy on immigration, we're creating a distinctive second-class or underclass group of people in our country and in our communities where they are at great risk of exploitation and discrimination and ultimately disenfranchisement. And it's really that issue that we end up working hard against. We drive people underground and away from government, and it's where those unintended consequences that Nadia talked about become evident, where children may not get an education, may not get health care and vaccinations, well baby care, communicable diseases don't get treated, where people are simply afraid to deal with the issues that they may face, resulting in ultimately a lack of safety and an unhealthy environment for all of the community. We've worked hard in Arlington to avoid this situation by not making distinctions among people, except, and this is part of the problem, we're mandated to do so by the federal and state government. What we try to do is accept a policy where we just simply treat people as people, and again, to create an inclusive environment through outreach programs, through neighborhood leadership training, through helping promote citizenship and providing English language training ourselves. We recently conducted a series of dialogues across our community with multicultural audiences around diversity and what it means, what we call diversity dialogues, and in an effort to try to bring people together and promote understanding. And we very much have tried to lead the way in the Washington region in this effort and to set a tone. And for us, it's been very positive. There is a strong sense of community pride in Arlington about our position. We have good schools and low crime. And during this current economic downturn, Arlington has experienced the best retention of property values really of any community in the Washington region. Our citizens have an 87% satisfaction rate of government. 69% include in our approach toward inclusiveness, and 67% agree with our approach to embrace diversity. But sometimes we really feel like we're swimming upstream, and that's why this report is important and why in the midst of all of the other things we're trying to grapple with as a country and a new administration, we need to not forget about immigration reform. We do need to control our borders. We need to bring people out of the shadows. We need to provide a path to citizenship. The law enforcement efforts need to focus on serious crime. We need to provide the English language training that immigrants so desperately want. And most importantly, as a nation and as local governments, we really need to stand boldly for human dignity and for the rights of all people. And that's what we would like to see come out of a national immigration policy. My colleague in the other Washington, Dale O'Leary, will tell you about some of his experiences.
Thank you. Let me tell you a little bit about Shelton, Washington. We are a city of around 9,000 people. There's a fairly large Latino population. It's kind of hard to tell exactly how many people we have. The latest census shows it's around 11%, but it's probably somewhat larger than that due to the undocumented folks that are here. They generally work in the brush gathering and shellfish industries. Our primary challenge in Shelton has been budgetary and just finding a way to keep the library open, for instance, given the failing economy and the limited resources. And our interest in this is primarily regarding crime prevention efforts. It's important, and I think that was said earlier, and I really want to emphasize this, that when you're engaged in this activity, it's very important to develop relationships with people. That way you can find out what's going on and address it before it happens, or at least after a crime has been committed, you have a pretty good handle on who's done it and what you can do about it. We work very hard at this effort, and the challenge that you have with immigrant communities is that a lot of the folks that have come here from other countries, government was not necessarily there to help you. In fact, a lot of these folks believe that, at least from where they came from, the government's there to hurt you. And so in order to develop relationships with them, we've had to work very hard, and we've been successful until we get a roundup or a raid that ICE comes through on. Now, let me say, first of all, that we don't begrudge the immigration folks doing their job. They've been hired to do these things. And, you know, how do you say you can't do that? Our job is law enforcement, too. But their mission is different from our mission. And when they do that, it gets in the way. The relationships that we built through this process fail. And we've got to start over again and try to rebuild bridges and rebuilding trust. There's crime everywhere. There's crime in the immigrant community. There's also crime in the non-immigrant community. And if you aren't there in what is effectively a subculture, a language subculture, among other things, you lose control over it, and you really need to be there in order to address it proactively. And if you don't have those relationships, you are unable to do that. And I would say, you know, based on our experience here in Shelton, we do need immigration reform. We have not. Our needs are more practical. We're pretty small. We really don't have the resources or the inclination to engage in the national debate. We're a long ways from the other Washington in our Washington. Our needs are pretty practical. We just need to be able to do our job and not have policies in Washington that frustrate that. So now I think I'm supposed to transfer it to back to Nadia.
Okay. What I'd like to talk about now are the policy recommendations that are included at the end of the report. The ICMA report concludes with a series of policy recommendations that reflect four guiding principles. And organized around those principles, 16 specific recommendations are presented that are drawn from the experiences of professional local government administrators and which we believe should be used to guide revisions and improvements to federal immigration policy. The first principle is that federal immigration policy should be overhauled to reflect 21st century economic and social realities, and that enforcement must be recognized as a necessary but not sufficient component of immigration policy. What this means is that we need to provide fair and lawful ways for businesses in the U.S. to hire the much-needed immigrant workers. We need to speed processing time to reduce the unreasonable and counterproductive backlogs in family-based and employment-based visa applications. We need to provide a path to legalization for hardworking individuals who have not violated any criminal laws and whose only offense is a violation of civil immigration laws. We need to use technology and intelligence to target enforcement efforts at the coyotes, human smugglers, employers, and others who take advantage of and profit from vulnerable immigrants rather than targeting the immigrants themselves. We need to improve international relations with, and if possible, aid to countries from which large numbers of immigrants arrive. The second principle is that the natural division of responsibilities places immigration control at the national level and immigrant integration at the local level. This means that specifically what needs to change is that we should cease pressures on local law enforcement officials to enforce federal civil immigration laws and state unequivocally in federal law that the role of local and state officials is limited to criminal law, not civil immigration laws. If we're going to have 287G programs and memoranda of agreements or understanding between ICE and local governments, there needs to be some consistency, and the federal government should work collaboratively with ICMA to develop a model MOU to ensure that this consistency exists. And we need to provide support for immigrant integration activities at the local level, including but not limited to English language instruction. The third principle is that federal enforcement activities should consider the impact on communities and local governments and should generally promote human rights. So while we do want to have the federal government rigorously enforce workplace laws, they should do so for all categories of employees within the United States. when ICE is going to engage in some sort of raid. Decisions about those raids or detention and deportation that may follow should consider the impact on children and communities. We should, wherever possible, utilize alternatives to mass detention, which have been demonstrated to be extremely costly and not particularly effective. And under no circumstances should immigration actions be taken based on information gathered from medical personnel. The public health concerns need to trump those enforcement concerns for everyone's safety. And the fourth principle is that resources generated by immigrants should be equitably redistributed. That federal tax revenue from immigrants should be shared with local governments in proportion with their experienced rates of immigration. The federal government should provide funding for English language instruction. Existing programs that provide support for criminal detention by local and state officials, like the State Criminal Alien Assistance Program, or SCAP, should be fully funded. And we should expand the model that's currently used for refugees to provide support to secondary resettlement communities who also incur significant costs but are not eligible for resources from the federal government. In sum, immigrants have made and continue to make important contributions to the economy and the culture of individual communities and the United States as a whole. And what we're looking for is a more cooperative and collaborative effort between local governments and the federal government for a comprehensive and cohesive and coherent policy or set of policies. In the current environment, where the Obama administration and the Congress is quite rightly focused on the economy as their top priority, it might be tempting to set aside the immigration issue and see this as something that has to wait until later. But I think all of the people on the press conference speaking today would agree that it's even more important now that local governments not waste their resources engaging in activities that are not their priorities, that we not engage in activities that are counterproductive to public health and public safety, and that we do things that promote a sense of community cohesion in communities across the United States. And one of the ways to do that is through comprehensive immigration reform that allows the federal government to focus on control and processing of immigration applications and allows the local governments to focus on immigrant integration within their communities. I'll turn things back over to Beth.
That was a great wrap-up, Nadia. I would just reinforce the point that you made that almost anything we want to accomplish in this country requires cooperation among the local, state, and federal government. I can't think of anything significant that we're trying to accomplish that doesn't require that kind of intergovernmental partnership. So I'm just going to reinforce that point, and I think at this point, let's open it up for questions. Anyone on the line have a question?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one key on your touch-tone phone. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one key on your touch-tone phone. To remove yourself from queue, please press the pound key at any time. We can pause a moment to allow questions to queue. We'll take our first question from the site of Hank Silverberg from WTOP Radio. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Ron, you were talking a little bit about what Arlington is doing, and I was just wondering, in light of what some of the other people said about coordination, is not one of the problems here that your county and other counties don't necessarily agree, and that what was not Arlington's problem one day may be Arlington's problem the next because of a decision in Prince William or Fairfax and the neighboring counties? The counties don't seem to even coordinate, much less the state or federal government.
Well, you're exactly right, Hank. Thanks for joining us. That's part of the lack of a national policy. People are left out there to make it up as they go, and that's not working very well. As you will recall, when Prince William was taking a very aggressive, I would say, anti-immigrant approach. It put a lot of pressure on us to even be more aggressive with our approach toward inclusion, because there was developing a national reputation that what was going on in Prince William was representative of Northern Virginia, and it very much was not. Arlington, Alexandria, Falls Church, Fairfax County all took a very different path on the immigration issue, but the voice in Prince William was creating an image and a environment that was very counterproductive for what we were trying to do. And so part of national reform, I think, really has to be about the national, about the federal government and our national leadership setting a consistent message about the value of human rights and setting coherent, you know, national policies that control immigration at the border. And then once people get here, give them the tools that they need to be successful in our country. And I think if we can do that, the some of the rhetoric and confusion that has occurred across local borders can be significantly diminished.
Well, it's not just rhetoric and confusion. It's actually migration. Folks who are getting bad vibes in Prince William would move to Arlington. And that puts more stress on you, does it not?
Well, no, that's fine. We're happy to have them in Arlington. That's really not a concern to us. Actually, quite frankly, the bigger concern we have in Arlington is not getting too many immigrants into our community, but that as we have become more culturally diverse and a more attractive community, our bigger problem is maintaining affordability of housing, even in the current market, so that we can preserve our diversity. And so the issue of people feeling unwanted in another community coming to ours, we're happy to have them, because we find the immigrants that come into our community come there for the same reason most of us did, and most of us are not native Arlingtonians. In fact, not a single member of the county board in Arlington is a native Arlingtonian. You know, we all came there for opportunity. We came there to work and to be successful. And whether people came from Alabama like me or came from El Salvador like one of our county board members, we're all there for the same purpose. And so we're happy to have people come from other communities if they feel more welcome in Arlington.
And I just one follow-up. Someone mentioned that the tax dollars generated by immigrants goes right to the federal government. There is a misconception out there that immigrants don't produce any tax dollars. What's being done to change that perception that might help in forming this national policy?
Well, I think the tax issues with immigrants that end up being really problematic is where we drive an underground economy and people can't or don't pay federal and state income tax or Medicare and Social Security taxes, or if they do, they do under a false ID that doesn't get credited to them. At the local level, where we don't rely on income tax, an immigrant, legal or not, cannot avoid taxes. If you live in our community, you pay property taxes either directly or indirectly. If you live in an apartment and you pay your rent, your property taxes get paid. If you go to the store and buy things, you pay sales taxes. You at the local level, this is where I think there's a great misperception, it is by and large physically impossible to avoid paying local taxation. And so the immigrants in our community are paying at the local level, but in some instances they don't have the ability, because of federal and state rules, to even participate in some of the programs that we offer.
Thank you. Who's next?
We'll take our next question from the side of Marcela Sanchez of the New York Times. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. I actually have a question about the organization itself, ICME. I don't know how do you...
ICMA.
ICMA, I'm sorry. I want to know about your membership. I mean, obviously, I assume that all your members agree with what you're saying, and it makes me wonder how many are not members, how many localities would just reject, you know, being part of your organization.
Well, first I would say we did not have a vote of all 9,000 of our members, and these are the top appointed officials who serve in cities and counties across the country, and in fact around the world. We have a significant international membership. This is a leadership document. This was put out by our Governmental Affairs and Policy Committee. And certainly you would find, if you personally interviewed all 9,000 of our members, there would be individuals who would not agree. But there really, and Ron may be able to speak to this because he was on the policy committee, there was not real debate about the need for national reform, even for those that might see the issues a little bit differently.
I think that's right, Beth. While the aggressive, inclusive approach that we take in Arlington is certainly not shared in other communities or by all of my colleagues, I think if you look at the white paper in its substance, where it is talking about coming together at least around those things that we do agree on at a national level and doing something coherent about national policy, you will find very little disagreement across our 9,000 members that are spread literally from one part of the United States to the other and into the other countries, as Beth mentioned.
Let me ask, is Prince William County a member? Or
we have, I interviewed several of the top administrators in Prince William County because of the pressure that I knew the professional staff was under in that community. And again, we're looking here at the difference between professionally trained individuals versus elected officials. They have the responsibility to carry out the direction of their governing body. I would say if you want to take a look at some very well-developed thinking and documents, you shouldn't hesitate to look at Prince William County. They were rigorous. And let's just take police as one example. They went and the police chief actually traveled to New Jersey because he knew that there had been civil rights issues raised with the state administration there. He wanted to make sure that however they enforced the law in Prince William County, it did so in a way that protected the civil rights of the individuals. That was one reason that he and the county manager advocated that the county put video cameras in the cars so that they could assure that they were enforcing the laws as they should. But it was very difficult for the staff. They spent a lot of time and did a rigorous job to try to come up with a professional way to respond.
If I might add to that as well, as part of the research for the report, one of the things
I'm
that
sorry.
I see in my...
I'm sorry. May I ask who's talking?
This is Nadia Rubai Barrett.
I'm sorry. Okay.
That's okay.
Go ahead.
As part of doing the research for the report, one of the things that ICMA helped facilitate for me was a survey. It was an online survey. It was not done through any random sampling process, but we had over 500 responses from the professional local government administrators, and they did represent they were representative of the range of communities that are members of ICMA. And what we found is near universal agreement that the lack of comprehensive federal immigration policy was a problem. They did have differences in how they chose to respond to that problem at the local level, but they were in agreement on the need for changes at the national level. And what's interesting, and this actually relates back to the earlier question that Hank had asked, is that what we tend to see the most attention drawn to at the national level are the communities who have taken either a sanctuary approach or a very strong anti-immigrant ordinance approach, but those represent fewer than 5% of the respondents to this survey. The overwhelming majority of the respondents indicated that they take a more moderate approach, that they are not choosing to crack down, nor are they choosing to be very welcoming. They're simply trying to get by. They're trying to adjust in small ways to continue to be able to meet their local demands. And what they need is some assistance from the federal government, regardless of the political environment in their own cities and counties, that they can. They would all welcome some improvements in federal policy.
Could I just do one follow-up just because of what you just said? Is there a chance that that kind of assistance from the federal government didn't need to be a comprehensive immigration reform? I mean, do you explore other options? What else could the federal government do that would help localities even without comprehensive immigration reform, or you're not exploring that?
We haven't taken that challenge on. This was certainly an ambitious undertaking, and this was there was so much consistency about the need for national reform that that's where we started. It's not to say we couldn't look for other avenues, but that's where we started.
Well, and even within that framework, if you look at the component parts of the recommendations that are in Nadia's report, I think it would help, absent comprehensive reform, to take any of those component parts and work on them, whether it's consistency in the law enforcement program or helping people advance their citizenship and legalization applications. There are any number of areas where it would be helpful. The main message, though, is that we really need to get organized in a comprehensive way.
And I guess to reinforce Ron's point, ICMA is one of 21 organizations that's part of the National Homeland Security Consortium, and immigration reform was something that consortium agreed was a priority for change.
Let me jump in, too, to focus on your prior question a little bit. The fact that there are this is Dave O'Leary, by the way. That there are surely disagreements between communities about how to handle this issue underscores the need for leadership from the federal government. And we're just unable to do that locally. This is a national policy, and we need national leadership in order to bring it together.
Thank you.
We'll take our next question from the side of Jennifer Ludden of National Public Radio. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. You actually just started to address one of my questions, which was what are there some administrative changes the administration could make short of comprehensive reform by Congress that could help you? You know, they've talked about strengthening labor laws, for example, you know, in workplaces and other things. You did address that, but is there anything else that they could do? Have you had any signals from the Obama administration of things they might do on their own that could help you? And then the second question is there anything that you've seen that may come out of the budgets, the stimulus package that could go to some of the integration efforts you were talking about or other things that could help you with these populations?
Nadia, I'm going to ask if you know of any administrative changes that might be on the table.
Thanks, Beth, for putting me on the spot.
Well, just in case you might be aware of some possibilities.
Well, let me just mention one real quick while Nadia is thinking about it. Yesterday, there was released a Governmental Accountability Office report on the 287G program with a number of recommendations on how to improve that program consistent with what Dave O'Leary was talking about. That, in just one single instance, would be a great place to start, where a roadmap's already been prepared by the GAO.
And I don't know of any particular proposals that have been considered by the Obama administration that would address these issues, but I have heard a number of statements that suggest that the Obama administration recognizes the importance of these things. I recall even, trying to find the exact phrasing, from his inaugural address, a reference to extending a helping hand, not because out of charity, but because really it is in the interests of everyone. It's in the economic and social interests of everyone to be more inclusive. And so I think that suggests that in labor policies and in immigration policies more specifically, that the Obama administration will be looking for opportunities.
I can certainly indicate interest from the Obama administration. We have given a copy of our white paper to Cecilia Munoz, the head of the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, and she has indicated this will be something that the Obama administration focuses on. They have a number of things on their plate right now, but it's certainly important, I think, down the road.
And the transition team did meet with representatives from ICMA, National League of Cities, National Association of Counties, and other state and local government organizations during the transition to solicit from us our concerns. And I got a sense from the meeting that I attended is that they were looking for where there was commonality so that they could bring together and act on areas that we had a shared concern around.
Okay, thank you.
We'll take our next question from the side of Charles Erickson of Hispanic Link News. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. A couple of quick questions. First of all, how is the report available? Is it available now online, or should people send in for it? And secondly, what are you doing to disseminate the report to those people that need to get a hold of it and to read it who are in positions to take some action on it? Also, how long did it take you to prepare this report?
I'll answer the last question first and then turn it over to Beth for how it can be accessed and how it's being disseminated. I worked on the report from mid-March through October of 2008, essentially gathering information from local government officials and other research that had been conducted on this issue through the summer, and then the actual preparation of the report was in early fall of 2008.
Okay, thank you.
And the report is available on ICMA's website. Our website is icma.org. We'll have a link that we'll make available to all of you after the show, so we make it even easier for you. We have, as I said, disseminated not only to the Obama administration, but also we've sent it up to committee staff on the Hill that are looking at these issues.
Just to committee staff at this point. I said, you didn't send it to all members of Congress? Or
no, we have not sent it to all members of Congress.
Okay.
And just to clarify the exact way to access the white paper, it would be icma.org/immigration-white-paper.
And we'll take our next question from the site of Phil Goodwin. That's at WJMA-FM. Please go ahead.
Yes. Dr. Barrett, there is kind of a dichotomy up here in central Virginia. We've been covering this story for quite a while. There are a number of our agricultural people who, frankly, just can't get their crops in without some agricultural workers. And a number of them are illegal. And I remember covering a press conference with a Hispanic who was a member of the United States Army who stood up and said, look, I came to this country. I got my citizenship the right way. He said he wanted to bring his mother in, but he wanted to bring her in legally and that the laws, you know, should be enforced exactly. Now, my question is, do we need a change of law here, or is there a way that everybody ought to be treated exactly the same? Because it seems like some people are coming in and are having to go through an awful lot of legal hoops to get into this country, and other people are just coming across the border.
I think you raise an excellent point, Phil. And one of the things we have to recognize is that the existing federal policy, which has not been comprehensively overhauled in nearly half a century. Really, the admissions criteria and some of the processes date back to the 60s. The only thing we've really updated in recent years have been the enforcement provisions. And if we look back over the past several decades, what we see is that there has been an implicit acceptance of illegal immigrants because we have not consistently enforced workplace laws against hiring illegal immigrants. Sometimes there are crackdowns, but many times employers know that they're not going to get caught doing this, and so they continue to do this. We also have a system where we have backlogs that sometimes date for 5 to 15 years that people wait to bring in family members or to have their visa applications approved to enter legally. That's just not a realistic set of circumstances to have. When you combine those two things, we're sending a message that you have to come illegally, or some people are going to have to come illegally to meet the demand, and that it's worth the risk. And we also have to consider, whenever we're talking about immigration, whether it's legal or undocumented immigration, both the push and the pull factors, that even in the current economic decline that we're facing, the serious economic decline we're facing here in the United States, we're seeing a slight decrease in the influx of new immigrants, but no measurable outflow among the immigrants who are already here, because things are still even worse in their native countries. So there's an economic incentive to better themselves and to better their lives for their family, and many of them are willing to take that risk to come even illegally. And I understand fully the frustration that people feel if they waited and are continuing to wait to bring family members to enter legally. I also understand the frustration of native-born people who are seeing illegal immigrants as a representation of breaking the law and disrespect for flaunting the rule of law. But we also have to recognize that we have created a set of circumstances, or allowed to develop a set of circumstances, that foster that condition. And so that's part of what we need to change, is we need to have policies for admissions that reflect the demand, and that demand changes. And so those policies have to be reevaluated over time. We have to have the ability to process. And in some cases, some processing is still being done in a paper version. And so we need to have more technologically sophisticated processing so that it can be more rapid without compromising security. And clearly there are background checks that need to be done, and we need to make sure that we're not compromising national security. But that shouldn't take 5 or 10 or 15 years to check those things on any individual. And we need to make sure that all of that is within a system that recognizes that even those of us who have been here for multiple generations, ultimately, if we go back far enough, almost all of us in this country are the result of immigration. And our previous generations and our family were immigrants. And the same reason that those people came is the reason that people are continuing to come. And so, you know, closing the door at any point in time is just not a realistic thing to do, so we need to have a rational policy. I'm not sure if that answered your question, Phil.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touchtone phone. And to remove yourself from queue, please press the pound key. We'll take our next question from the side of Hank Silverberg of WTOP.
Just one more question concerning the backlog. Can you talk a little bit about how long it takes to get into this country legally? If you're trying to bring in a relative, or if you're sitting in Mexico somewhere, or Guatemala, or Indonesia for that matter, trying to get into this country, how long from the time you actually make an application does it take to get reviewed, to get admitted into this country, and then once you're here, assuming you qualify everything, to get citizenship?
I can if you give me a moment. As you might imagine, those are not numbers that I keep at the top of my head, but they are included in the report, so yes. What we have, and these are a year or two old because the information is, you know, the reports come out from these federal agencies on an annual basis. But in 2007, the U.S. Customs and Immigration Service, which handles the immigration and naturalization side of immigration policy at the federal level, was processing some family-related visa applications that were filed more than a decade ago, and employment-related applications filed 5 or 6 years before that. So there's a delay depending on what type of visa application of anywhere from 5 to 10 years. For those who are our immigrants who are already in the U.S., who are seeking to bring spouses and children, immediate family members, people who are legal permanent residents, they can expect to wait at least 5 years regardless of their country of origin. And a large part of that is simply insufficient staff to process the volume of applications. an outdated paper-based processing system, and a backlog in the FBI's name-checking and background-checking process. And for U.S. citizens who want to sponsor a family member from Mexico is just a specific example. This is not an immigrant wanting to bring a family member, a legal permanent resident, but a U.S. citizen who wants to sponsor a family member, but not an immediate family, so say someone like an unmarried adult child of yours, and you're a U.S. citizen. If that person is from Mexico, you may wait up to 15 years before that application will be processed. And that's from 2007. I don't have any reason to believe that got any better in 2008.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It appears that we have no further questions at this time.
Okay. Sounds like our time here has come to an end. I thank everybody for participating.
Thank you.
Bye.